The next 14 months were a series of treatments, hospital visits, setbacks, experimental drugs, and slow deterioration. My sister is a dedicated believer in Jesus Christ, and when she found out this diagnosis, immediately called family and friends and her church to pray. And so in the last 14 months, hundreds of people have prayed thousands upon thousands of prayers for her. She was hoping for a miracle, because when the doctors could not operate, they told her that this cancer is fatal. No one lives past 2 years, and few only more than a few months. Which brings me to my visit 2 weeks ago. Her husband, Dan, has been by her side the whole time, except the weekend before when surgery was needed for him. It could not be postponed any longer. And he was in the hospital battling an infection from the surgery, and she was worried about him. So can you get the picture? Here I am beside this hospital bed in my sister's living room, holding her hand. She is now in the last laps of death's slow journey. The tumors have moved into her esophagus, and she can no longer eat. She is still alive after 2 weeks. You wonder how long you can go without food, but she has. Thankfully, the pain medication is keeping things under control, but she can feel the tumors underneath her skin growing, and her husband is not there, even though she is never left alone. The one person she wants with her is in the hospital. As I sit beside her at the hospital bed, she looks up at me with tears in her eyes and suddenly says, "We prayed and we prayed and we prayed, and now Dan's in the hospital. I just don't understand. I just don't understand." I am her brother, who has become a pastor and a seminary professor, and she is challenging, lamenting, pleading, asking, "I just don't understand. What do I say?" This theological symposium is more than just panel discussions and debating points. It is more than seeing where a position goes or where it has come from. It is taking what we believe, what we teach, and intersecting it with the deepest questions of life in faith and doubt. If you have not had to wrestle with those deeper questions, just wait, you will. In fact, I sort of wonder if you haven't, if you've seen some of the pictures that have come out of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. I remember one picture, the helicopter is looking down, there is water through the streets, and there is a sheet covering a body and words scrawled on that sheet, something like, "Vera's dead, send help." To me, that's wrestling with God's will in a tragic world. But back to the bedside of my sister, I can tell you what I did not tell her. I did not go into detail about the classic or traditional theist position. I didn't look at her and say, "Well, Joy, I know you said all those prayers and so did so many other people, but God is immutable. He doesn't change his mind. He knows what will happen in the future. He is in control. He decides what will and will not happen. All the prayers in the world couldn't persuade him to do something different than what he has already ordained. I know he's told us to pray, so we do, but that's more to conform us to his will. It's not to somehow influence what we want him to do. Not my will, but thy will is what you need to understand." I didn't go to the immutability of God, nor did I go into detail about the more recent open theism position about the persuadability of God. I didn't say, "Well, Joy, God does want us to pray because the future is uncertain. His mind isn't settled yet about it. We can influence what he will do, giving our input as to what we want to happen. With enough prayer, God can be persuaded to do something that no doctor would have ever expected, even a miracle. But he didn't do that for you. I wonder what more we could have done to change his mind. 100 prayers? 1,000? 100,000? I guess we'll just have to wait and see why we couldn't get him to change his mind. I didn't go to the persuadability of God either. So what did I say? Well, you're going to have to wait for that. But this symposium has taken on a rather special, urgent, personal meaning for me. And it will, or it has already for you. You will be called upon in your ministry for people who just don't understand in the midst of tragedy. Or you will stand before a Bible class after a hurricane or a tsunami or a Twin Towers, and people will be looking at you to make some sort of sense out of this tragedy. Or it could be your own family member, or it could be you. Now, I wrote this that I've just said last Friday in preparation for this in order so that you could see what filters, what biases I had as I brought to this assignment. Now, this is what I wrote last night, after having sat through the presentations and the responses. Now, what do we've learned? Well, that may be a bit presumptuous, the we part, that is. What follows is what I've gleaned from our time together so far. And what I've learned is that I can't organize everything that's gone by my brain. Too much has been said in too short of time, too many notes, too many philosophical categories, Dr. Blunt. Too many distinctions, too many tensions, too many Bible passages, words that needed to be translated and explained. And besides, I don't see my task as trying to summarize what's all been said, but to latch on a few items and take them somewhere. So here goes. First item. Dr. Blunt stepped away from his prepared text yesterday to tell of a speaker he was listening to at some conference. It was someone who was defending the more classical or traditional theist position. He had been challenged by an open theist that he was relying on philosophical categories for his position. And Dr. Blunt, you were disappointed in his answer because he started to try to argue that he was not relying on those philosophical positions. And your response was, that's not a good response. The response you needed to make was, yes, I am. And so do you. Exactly. We will come at these questions of God's will in a tragic world with presuppositions, filters, biases, traditions, formal and material principles. As Lutherans, we need to not only be aware of them, but to openly work from them. We've heard the key ones these past 24 hours, the hidden and revealed God, law and gospel, the two realms of righteousness, the alien and proper work, the theology of glory and the theology of the cross. And especially the tension between the God who knows all, who has ascribed all those omni-attributes, and the God who is incarnational, who in time and space interacts and responds to people. It makes a difference. I sat between Dr. Blunt and Dr. Lessing yesterday afternoon in that chair. Dr. Lessing was working with the Old Testament exegesis of passages where God changes his mind, his actions, and went to the phrase, the holy mutability of God. I looked over at Dr. Blunt, writing furiously notes all over a piece of paper. He was working with the immutability of God. Something in the air told me that the Old Testament exegesis and the systematic categories of God didn't jive. And they don't. At least, not as we heard them yesterday. There are different starting points and filters, and they lead sometimes to the same place, but also to different conclusions. A couple examples. I don't find Dr. Blunt's distinction between the real and relational changes, the Bert and Ernie example. I preach and I teach homiletics. I listen to the examples and the illustrations. The Bert and Ernie example, to help as much as I think you would like. As Lutherans, we hold to the bondage of the human will in matter spiritual. Any change in the relationship between God and us does not originate or happen from our side. It comes from God's side, and it involves that change from law to gospel, death to life, giving us the very faith needed to believe. Even the relational change is caused by God, not by us. And that leads to the why some and not others, the question that Lutheran theology simply cannot and does not answer. So here's one issue in my mind that still remains, the freedom or the bondage of the human will in this question, particularly in light of the comments by Dr. Aaron yesterday in the two realms of righteousness, or the presentations this morning about human choice, Dr. Hartung's comment about God setting a buffet before us of choices. Another example. If you begin with the immutability of God, then the nature and purpose of prayer is a problem. About all you have left is that prayer, and we've heard this before, boomerangs back and is limited to conforming you to God's will. Scripture places other purposes before us, though, and Dr. Lessing and Dr. Robbie went into those. On the other hand, if you begin with the persuadability of God, then the nature or purpose of prayer quickly moves into a God that we can manage or tame or bend to our will, the God, perhaps, I suppose, behind the prayer of Jabez. It falters on the ramifications of who God is and what it means to be God. And I'm still uneasy about Dr. Lessing's statement, this means Yahweh is not immutable in some absolute sense. Here, too, is an issue that remains, the nature and purpose of prayer. And behind that is this question about the language we use to talk about God, metaphorical, anthropological, and I come back to, does God have lungs before Jesus is incarnate? If we say that he changes his mind, where does our language falter and where is it consistent? I've learned that we need to steer through this paradox, the tensions, maintain the both and, but it is difficult to do that steering while we live and speak to people in the midst of tragedy. A second item that I want to talk about here is that Dr. Aaron mentioned some science fiction movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I can't say that I've seen it, but I've recently read a short story called Death's Door by Terry Bisson. It's a different take on the death takes a holiday theme. For 2 days, no one dies. Sounds great, huh? Our enemy kept at bay. No, it doesn't sound great. Because in this story, tragedy is still present. It's not the plane doesn't crash so everybody lives. In this story, the plane crashes. And people still live. Listen. It was the one thing they weren't prepared for. As Jean-Claude, the plane crashed in France, poked through the wreckage, he found bodies and parts of bodies. The ones that were whole or even partly whole were still alive. My wife, one man was cut almost in half. His entrails were falling out all over his cheap suit. But he was still alive, asking about his wife in bad African French. We're looking for her, Jean-Claude said, even though it wasn't true. They were looking for parts of her, for parts of all of them. Bring her to me, s'il vous plaît. Let me see her before I die. Oui. Jean-Claude waited for the man to close his eyes, but he didn't. Jean-Claude resisted the impulse to reach out and close them for him. People were screaming all around him. They're all burned, said Bruno, a second in command. They come to pieces when we pull them out. But they won't stop screaming. I'll help load them up, said Jean-Claude. When he got back to the African, he was still alive, still clutching his entrails. Load them up, says Jean-Claude. My God, he said to Bruno, this is the worst yet. An air disaster with hundreds of survivors. Now, interspersed between the various stories of people surviving disasters is another storyline in this book about someone who is approaching the light. They are in one of these states where they should have died but haven't, and it's a little spark and it's approaching this light. You've heard the stories of being in a tunnel and going through it, but the person's waiting for the moment when her body gives out on Earth. She sees countless of other sparks of life moving towards the horizon of light, but she can't remember her name until the moment death returns. Listen again. So much light, there it was, all of a sudden, lots of it, extinguishing the sparks. The sparks, one by one, like raindrops in the sea. Ruth, that was it, that was her name. Then it wasn't. The story haunts me, because there's no hope in this life if death takes a holiday. And in this story, there's no hope in the next life if death goes back to work. There's no hope. It's tragic either way. I have another sister, and she is Unitarian. She sees Jesus as merely the golden rule. Many years ago, her oldest daughter, young mother with a baby, was killed in a senseless car accident. When we came to grieve at her house, she openly said that her daughter was simply gone, no hope, challenging and denying us who would bring Jesus to her. She is now helping to take care of my sister with cancer. Her comment is simply, "Joy didn't deserve this. It isn't fair." Again, no hope. So where is this leading? A number of times I've heard about one position cannot trump another. We need both and in place, but we do have a trump card. It is the resurrection from the dead. We will have a name. Tragedies will cease. A day of the Lord will come in all its fullness. This is our hope. We may not be able to answer the why question with any logical satisfaction. Theodicy is a dead end, and when we try to investigate the hiddenness of God, but the trump card is the resurrection. Here again is another issue that remains, the implication of the resurrection during tragic times. And I moved to that yesterday when I asked one question following Dr. Gibbs' comments. It was having to do whether we relativize tragedy when we play this trump card. All four responders jumped in. No, the resurrection takes death seriously, an enemy to be overcome, to be defeated, and does so not as a light moving towards light, but in a full bodily victory on the last day. And that is our hope. But Dr. Blunt, you called us back to the in-between, the time between Christ's resurrection and ours. And people still feel lost, still hurt deeply in the tragedy. And here is the one tension that I would like to have heard of more yesterday, and we got to this morning briefly, that we are saint and sinner at the same time as we live between the two resurrections. An example. My sister with cancer is now struggling not so much with the "I don't understand." I just talked to her this week. She has now asked that we pray for Satan to get away from her. For days, all she can do is lie in this hospital bed and think. Her thoughts are not always saint-like. And what has moved into her now is this whole person relationship with the Lord. It has moved beyond the why question. It has moved to the doubts that are rising up and laying hold of her. She wants peace in her soul, but it does not come. And here is where the face of the in-between challenges us in our ministry. The saint sinner is before us, and the hope we have is clouded by loss and tragedy and death. Yet Paul says we do not grieve as unbelievers, but as those with hope. And so here is another issue. How do we bring the resurrection to the saint whose sinful self is squeezing faith in tragedy? And my third item. Dr. Blunt, you mentioned Bono from U2 yesterday, somewhere in there, I believe, describing the clash between the two realities. God is, in a sense, accountable for this tragedy. We heard that in Job and Isaiah. It's not good to somehow let God off the hook here. But he is also the gracious and good God. Two songs, and they go at these two realities. Well, I received a sermon illustration by email that quotes Bono in another context. Here it is, Theology by Bono, probably a first for this symposium. But listen to what he says. Saying that the idea of karma is central to all religions, Bono explained, "When you put out what comes back to you, what you put out comes back to you. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Or in physics, in physical laws, every action is met by an equal or an opposite one. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it. And yet along comes this idea called grace to upend all that. As you weep, so you will soul stuff. Grace defies reason and logic. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff. It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity. I heard something similar in a sermon by Fred Craddock. He was speaking of the expectations of the disciples of the people when it came to the Messiah. He writes, "Now it was hard for the 12 who were with him, extremely hard, because they had their expectations of a Messiah. No question about it. When the Messiah comes, every beautiful story started that way. Like we would start one once upon a time. They started them. When the Messiah comes, beggar on a street, tin can fastened to the neck of his guitar. Brother, I'm sorry, I don't have any money, but when the Messiah comes, there will be no poverty. See the cripple, useless limbs folded beneath the trunk of his body? Brother, I wish I could help you, but when the Messiah comes, there will be no cripples. The young girl assaulted by a Roman soldier, the father pats her on her back, honey, I know, but when the Messiah comes, no violence. Go to the home of a couple married 14 years, still rocking an empty cradle. Well, when the Messiah comes, every house will be full of happy, laughy children. When the Messiah comes, there will be no misery." And then Jesus came and they said, "He's the Messiah." And look what happened. There was misery. And those 12 disciples had to make a majestic flip-flop. Wherever the Messiah is, there is no misery. And now they have to believe that wherever there is misery, there's the Messiah. Dr. Aaron mentioned that this topic is like an iceberg, with much going on underneath and a few peaks rising above for us to see. One peak rises higher than the rest. We call it Mount Calvary. He's got the whole world in his hands, and his hands are nailed to the cross. Finally, what do you say? Now, this isn't all that you say. But finally, what we have to say is what is revealed. God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were yet helpless and powerless and sinners, Christ died for us. Or Jesus, "Show us the Father and that will be enough," one says. Is it a request to peek into the hiddenness of God? And Jesus says, "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. No one comes to the Father except through me." Now, there are other issues to be dealt with that I haven't addressed. Pick a sectional, but in this one area, it's settled. What do we say? The last and sometimes only word is still Jesus. So what did I say to my sister? As Dr. Rowald pointed out yesterday, sometimes Job is the one that spoke, sometimes his wife, the friends, or God. As I sat beside that hospital bed in my sister's living room, I did not speak as a pastor. I did not speak as a seminary professor. I spoke as her brother. And I leaned over and I simply said, "Joy, I love you." And she nodded back. And then I spoke as a brother in the faith. And so does Jesus. Hold on to Jesus. Thank you.